This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This week on Witness History, the smart speaker Alexa is used by hundreds of millions of people around the world. But did you know its voice was created by two students in Poland? After watching old sci-fi movies, Łukasz and Michał decided they could create a device which sounded less robotic and more like a human. After spending years developing their own technology, they started winning awards, and big companies like Amazon took notice. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Jill McGivering, this week on assignment in Cambodia. It's around 6 in the morning, and I'm standing in hushed darkness with a crowd of a few hundred tourists from all over the world, getting ready to greet the dawn. A canopy of bright stars stretches overhead. We've gathered inside the compound of the world's biggest religious monument, the 12th century Angkor Wat Temple in northwest Cambodia. A first soft light is steadily growing. And there it is. The sun is rising into view behind this ancient temple, and it's all reflected in the lake. It is magical. Angkor Wat is the most famous of dozens of temples studded across the vast jungle of Angkor Park. More than 30 years ago, the park was designated a World Heritage Site by the UN's cultural body, UNESCO. About 100,000 villagers live inside the park's boundaries. Many now accuse the Cambodian authorities of using that World Heritage status as an excuse to seize their land or force them from their homes. Others say they're being threatened and harassed because they refuse to go. Cambodia is an up-and-coming tourist destination, and this area, Angkor Park, is a big money spinner for the authorities. Every one-day entry pass for the temples costs $37. Angkor Wat is the star attraction. Officials have predicted that if they develop this region carefully, then in 10 years' time, they could see 7.5 million foreign visitors every year. That's an explosion compared with today. The Angkor temples are certainly a magnet. The tourist district in the nearby city is buzzing with foreigners eating, drinking and shopping. When the site gained World Heritage status, the government set up a special body to regulate and protect Angkor Park, the jungle area which surrounds the ancient ruins. Now the authorities seem to want control of the whole park. It's unclear why. There's little accountability here, and future plans haven't been made public. But the authorities have started a mass relocation programme to move villagers who live inside the park to areas outside it. That's proving extremely controversial. I've come off the beaten track into the jungle and I found a group of stonemasons sweating as they labour under the sun. Almost everywhere you go in Angkor Park, there are piles of stones from ruined temples. I've come to meet one stonemason whose family has worked on the temples for generations. We followed him on his motorbike down dirt tracks through the rice paddies and come to his house set about by trees. It couldn't be more traditional, an open wood structure on stilts with a simple palm frond roof. As I arrive, his wife and daughter are just walking in back from the rice fields, and they soon start cooking up lunch in a metal pot on an open fire.
I have many skills as a stonemason. I chisel and stack stones, and I also match them up. I can turn my hand to most things when it comes to stones.
You and your family have been here for so long, all these generations going back for so long on this land. Do you feel safe that you are not under pressure to leave your land?
They asked us to relocate. We've already said we don't want to leave our ancestral land. What is on offer is not enough. How are we going to survive? There is not one banana tree there, nowhere to grow things like lemongrass. We have to stay and live on the land left by my ancestors.
He might not come across as angry because his tone of voice is so gentle, but as he spoke, his jaw was set and his gaze steely. Staying calm is highly prized in Cambodian culture. This country has seen near constant turmoil in the last century. It's been colonized and invaded. It's seen civil war and the brutal regime of the communist Khmer Rouge. So many have had to leave their land before. Now they're being forced to move again, this time in the name of development. Thousands of people have been relocated here to Run Ta Ek. It's about half an hour's drive from Angkor Park, a vast, flat, featureless plain, cleared of natural jungle and divided into row upon row of identical tiny plots. People who moved out here from Angkor were given initial food, corrugated metal sheets and tarpaulin for shelter. So many of the houses are one-room metal boxes. They must be sweltering in this heat. There isn't even any shade. They were also promised 10 years of cash payments to compensate for loss of income and property. I came across this family trying to pump clean water and getting clay sludge. The mother had just cycled home from a job sewing shirts. She volunteered to move here with her husband and three children because they didn't have their own house before. But they faced constant problems. Life isn't easy, she told me. When it rains, the floor floods and the roof leaks. We don't have enough money to finish off the house. There are no trees here, and it's so hot, she added. The children have to walk miles to school. I don't have money to pay for transport. But my main concern is about making ends meet. It's so far from any work. About 20,000 people have moved to Run Ta Ek now, but I'm driving round the perimeter road and there's barely a soul in sight. Most houses look closed up. There's no washing hanging out, no smoke rising, no children playing. It's practically a ghost town. I have found someone else to talk to, though. He doesn't want me to use his name because he's too frightened of getting into trouble, but he's brought me to see his newly built house. He's saying the house cost him $11,000 to build. He sold his cows and his motorbike and pawned his social security card, but he still had to take out a loan from the bank for $7,000 to cover the gap. What's it like living here? He's saying it's difficult living here. He can't earn a living, there's no work. He's saying if you look at this block of 200 families, only about 10 families are actually still living here. They can't find work either, so the others have all gone back to their villages or they're renting a room in the city. He's telling me he's living in a hut back in his home village and that he only comes here for maybe one night in every couple of weeks. Back at his village, inside Angkor Park, I walked through rice paddies, past sleepy buffalo, to find where he used to live. So he's showing me the area. It's just a flat concrete foundation that used to be the house. He's saying over there was the kitchen, over there in the corner was the bathroom. It's impossible to tell because there's nothing left of it. What happened to the house? He's saying his house was wooden, built out of palm trees, but he had to knock it all down, dismantle it, because the authorities came here and told him he had to leave this place. He's brought me over to show me this shack they've put up where they're living. You have a situation now. You've knocked down your lovely house. You and your wife and your mother-in-law are living in the cattle shed. That makes no sense. He's saying to me, you're right, it makes no sense, but as long as they just leave me alone, I'll carry on living here, because I need to work. His wife has come over now to have a word with me as well. She's saying that they came to ask if they wanted to volunteer to go to Runtaek, and they said, no, we don't want to go. And then later, a senior government official came and talked to us directly and asked why didn't we want to go, and we explained. And he said, I don't care. You have to put your names down for a plot of land. And then we got frightened. Some villagers are so frightened of being forced off their land that they're joining forces to fight back. I've driven into the jungle. We're about 20 minutes away from Angkor Wat Temple to a large compound with a traditional Cambodian stilt house and two smaller homes. As I arrive, people are converging from nearby villages by foot and by motorbike, scattering the chickens and setting the dogs barking. They rush out plastic chairs and we settle in the shade, under a shelter of wooden poles and dried palm fronds. They're grim-faced and they all have a story to tell. Can I just ask, of all of you, you must be 12, 14 people, men and women, how many of you feel there is a real problem about being forced out of your homes? So they're all putting their hands up and they're all saying very emphatically, yes, we feel like that. The villagers say they're being monitored all the time. They say the authorities don't only mount daily patrols, they also spy on the villagers at night.
We're scared. When people are sleeping, they fly the drones. When people get truckloads of soil to fill in after the rains or try to rebuild fences, the drones arrive later that day. The lights on the drones flicker. When a drone flies low, it makes a noise. It hovers over when people are doing any work, and they come to try and stop it. It's 24-hour surveillance by the authorities. People try to chase them off or film what's going on with their mobile phones.
So while we're talking, other villagers are pulling out their mobile phones and they're showing us individual footage. And it shows officials in uniform who are coming into their houses, and that's a voice of an angry woman haranguing them, saying, why are you doing this? We're a long way from Angkor Wat. Why are you coming onto our property? A neighbour has joined in. She's taken up the story. That was her voice on the mobile phone footage when she was shouting at the officials.
They said that this land is part of the World Heritage Site and UNESCO needs to manage it correctly. They don't want buildings all over it. They want to keep it as it is.
That woman was clearly very upset and emotionally exhausted. They all are. What they're doing, trying to stand up to the authorities, is really dangerous. This is a highly charged issue. If the police catch any of them talking to me, they could be arrested. Even so, this woman agreed to talk to me some more and show me around her home. It only looks half built. It's got bare bricks, holes for windows and huge gaps in the walls. She and her husband were originally given permission to build. Then recently the authorities changed their mind. They've been here twice, she says, trying to knock it down.
They said that if we don't demolish this house, they'll bring in equipment and do it themselves. But we refused and slammed the gate shut to stop them from getting in. When they came to try and persuade us to leave, they said if anyone wants to build a house without any problems, they should go to Runtaek. But no one wants to go there.
This is the BBC World Service.
This week on Witness History, the smart speaker Alexa is used by hundreds of millions of people around the world. But did you know its voice was created by two students in Poland? After watching old sci-fi movies, Łukasz and Michał decided they could create a device which sounded less robotic and more like a human. After spending years developing their own technology, they started winning awards, and big companies like Amazon took notice. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service. What is at the heart of this? People being harassed, thrown off their land. What's it all for? I kept asking the villagers and no one seems to know. What is clear as I drive through Angkor Park is that change is rapidly taking place. I can see evidence of it right now. Just there by the road, there's an area of newly planted grass with rows of saplings. Apparently clusters of houses used to stand there. On the other side of the road, there's a line of open food stalls, but I'm told there used to be far more.
Something I have spotted are large official billboards along the road declaring a campaign to plant trees and grass to preserve the Angkor Wat heritage site. It's the strongest clue I've got so far that maybe the driving force behind all this is to smarten the whole place up.
I asked the government authorities to talk to me and answer these questions, and many more, but they didn't respond to our request for an interview. I did manage to speak to UNESCO. If you remember, villagers said the excuse used by officials harassing them was that they were only following UNESCO's orders. I asked Ernesto Otone Ramirez, UNESCO's Assistant Director General for Culture, if that was true.
Whatever decision is made by the authorities to ensure any relocation has to be voluntary and have to involve local communities in the engagement in policy management and protection process. So what is important to understand is that when they say that UNESCO is approving, no, we have not approved anything. What advisory body does are giving recommendation for ways to go on with the preservation of these sites to the government of Cambodia.
With respect, you are a long way away at the moment. Of course, you're based in Paris. It's very difficult for you to keep a close eye on exactly what's happening. We are here on the ground at the moment, and what we're seeing is causing a lot of concern. People who are being harassed, and when they protest, the officials say, it's not us, this is what UNESCO said must happen. UNESCO are the people. And they've been saying to us, please ask UNESCO, why are they doing this?
UNESCO has never been supporting any relocation that has been forced. What we have been doing is to work with our expert that can give the right advice to the Cambodian authorities that are in charge and the managers of the site. And that's why we send the mission, and we are waiting their report so that we can present and send to the authorities everything that has been seen on the ground. And now we are waiting the conclusion of this mission that will help us also to support all communities that feels that their human rights are violated.
Clearly, UNESCO is investigating what's happening, but it's a complex bureaucratic process, and that takes time. It's been hard during my visit to verify every individual allegation, especially as the authorities have chosen not to put their side of the story. But as I've spoken to people in different communities, in different parts of the park, a clear pattern has started to emerge of villagers who feel intimidated and harassed by the authorities here. I've travelled to another area of the park and found a woman in her 40s cooking up Cambodian noodles in a vast metal pot over an open fire. It's a modest roadside stall where local people stop for lunch. I'll call the noodle seller, Dara. Dara takes me somewhere quiet, away from prying eyes, to meet her older sister, Vanna. As soon as Vanna starts to tell me their story, she becomes overwhelmed. She says the authorities seized their rice fields and built a road and a canal.
No one told us anything about the plan for our land. They just went ahead and bulldozed our fields. I'm speechless. When we asked for compensation, they said the state is poor. They only gave me 5 big sacks of rice.
Your sister's clearly very upset. You seem a little calmer. How are you feeling about what's happened?
I won't be able to grow rice anymore, Dara told me. I'll just run my noodle stall. I do have another patch of land, she added, but it's studded with trees, and the authorities have already forbidden me from farming there. Last year I tried, and they threatened to arrest me. In other words, Dara isn't allowed to clear her own land so she can farm, but the authorities can seize her land to build on. Just then, Dara was called back to her stall to serve customers. Once she'd gone, I asked Vanna if, as well as having their fields seized, they'd also been asked to leave their home.
They asked us to volunteer. I said no. I want to live and die here. don't force me to leave. I don't want to go to a small plot and live there. If I say any more, I'll go to jail.
I asked Vana if she could take me to see her fields for myself. She's brought me a short distance from the house and she's showing me what used to be her rice fields. There's now a newly dug canal with a concrete sluice gate and a high earth bank, and alongside it they've built a raised dirt road. It cuts right across her land and her sister's land and land owned by other villagers too. They've taken about three quarters of it. On the way back, I passed Vana's neighbours, busy harvesting their rice crop with handheld sickles. For these small landholders, rice is everything, another word for food. From now on, for Dara and Vana, it's going to be a struggle. This is a country where speaking out is increasingly dangerous. Earlier, after some different interviews, someone tipped off the police that I'd been there, and they started asking awkward questions about who I was and what had been said. Back in his family compound in the trees, the stonemason's wife and daughter are serving up the soup. I asked him if he and his wife had been directly approached about leaving their home.
Yes, they came here. They came here to collect data for a census. I told them, we're not leaving. They came to measure the land, the width and the length and how many people in the household. After that, they came again and they took stock of what we had on the land, like the pigsty. And they said from then on there will be no building and no repairs. They asked if we would volunteer to go to Runtaek. We said no. They patrol every day. If they see someone even putting up one fence pole, they tear it down.
This land has been with you for generations. What would it mean to you if you were forced to leave it and go to Runtaek?
I'm burning with anger. I'm used to living on my ancestral land, from my parents, grandparents, great-grandparents. Over there, it's such a small space, and there's no work at all. Just thinking about this gets me angrier and angrier.
His wife has been cooking their lunch while we've been talking, and she's just come to join us sitting here under the trees. Can I ask you, how do you feel about this uncertainty about what's going to happen with the house and land?
I'm not happy at all. I don't want to go under any circumstances. When the officials first came to interview us, they insisted that we cannot stay, no matter what. They said UNESCO will evict you, and you must go.
So that's yet another person saying that the authorities have told them they must leave their homes, like it or not, because UNESCO wants them out. I asked Mr. Otone what UNESCO could do about these apparent human rights abuses, if its own field report confirmed what I've already witnessed. Would it, for example, consider rescinding Angkor's World Heritage status?
It's not the Secretariat of UNESCO who take this decision. It's the member states. And in this case, the committee of the World Heritage who inscribed this site has to take decision. The next meeting will be held in June of next year. And the decisions can be either doing recommendation on the ground to change what is happening, or even, as you mentioned, to put the World Heritage list in danger or going to the withdrawal of our World Heritage sites.
You have your processes, I do understand that. Can you understand how difficult it is for people here? They're frightened of even talking about this. Can you understand that it's hard for them to be patient?
Yes, but it's hard also for Afghan women right now, and we are doing our best to support them. It's complicated for the people that are in Gaza. So yes, we are aware, but we can use only the instrument that we have at our disposal to do so.
How does it make you feel hearing that UNESCO's name is being used inappropriately in the way I've described on the ground, that you're being used as a pretext for what certainly appear to be human rights abuses?
We have published many times communication saying that UNESCO has neither requested, supported, nor participated in this reclamation program. And we are deeply concerned. Not concerned, deeply concerned by the allegation of human rights violation.
So it is possible the UN could take punitive action against Cambodia. But the wheels of bureaucracy turn slowly. In the meantime, there's little sign of the authorities abandoning their plans. Remember that first resettlement site, Runtar Ek? All the plots there have been allocated now, but that doesn't mean the relocations are over. I've driven out to Pek Sneng, a massive new relocation site. It's in the middle of nowhere, as far from Angkor as Runtar Ek is. It's a desolate, windswept plain of cleared farmland, with line upon line of electricity poles and cables stretching into the distance. It's not completely empty. I've seen the first signs of a future water and sewage system. But the sheer size of the place gives an insight into the authorities' thinking. It will have twice the capacity of Runtar Ek. That suggests it could house around 40,000 people. It's the end of the day, and dusk is creeping over the jungle. I'm climbing a steep dirt track in the middle of a steady stream of tourists. We're all eager to make it to the summit before the sun sets. Well, I've made it, not only up the hill, but to the top of the ancient temple here. The view is stunning. I can see right across Angkor Park. Over there, the three stone towers of Angkor Wat, bathed in fading light. Cheers and applause as the sun disappears. Then the temple starts to empty. It's a moment of calm and a chance to reflect on everything I've seen and heard. It's hard to see a solution. UNESCO's role is to protect one of the world's great cultural treasures, including from the impact of an expanding population. The Cambodian authorities are keen to develop the park in the hope of getting money-making tourism to ever higher levels. And then there are the villagers. The stonemason in his forest home spoke for many when he told me he felt powerless.
We are only small people. Small people. But no matter how much they threaten us, we won't leave. We will wait and see what happens in the bitter end.
This week on Witness History, the smart speaker Alexa is used by hundreds of millions of people around the world. But did you know its voice was created by two students in Poland? After watching old sci-fi movies, Wukasz and Mikhail decided they could create a device which sounded less robotic and more like a human. After spending years developing their own technology, they started winning awards, and big companies like Amazon took notice. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your podcasts.